Welcome to Novel Romantics, a podcast about contemporary American fiction. I'm the host of Novel Romantics, Douglas Cowie. I'm a writer and a teacher, and my guest today is Shane Carmichael. Shane Carmichael is a consultant and lecturer at University College London and Warwick Business School, who specializes in public leadership and organization development. He has a longstanding interest in the role of leadership and narrative in conflict, having grown up in Northern Ireland through the Troubles. As a graduate, former board member and consultant of the Washington Ireland Program for Service and Leadership, which is a U.S. Ireland cross-community development program, and having previously provided support to two of its sister programs focusing on conflict, leadership, and narrative in South Africa and Israel-Palestine. He has a crush on Colin McCann. That's our important fact about Shane Carmichael for this month's podcast. So welcome, Shane.
Welcome. Thank you. Thank you, Doug. Thank you very much for having me along.
It's a pleasure to have you. Today, your crush on Colin McCann is relevant because today we're going to discuss A Paragon, the most recent novel by the Irish novelist Colin McCann. Colin McCann's originally from Dublin, but has lived in New York City since 1994. So I guess maybe we're blurring the lines of our contemporary American fiction remit on the podcast, but I think we're keeping in sync with one of the general ideas of the transatlanticist family of podcasts and sort of bridging the American-European divide there. I should point out at this stage that if you're a reader who worries about listening to the podcast and coming across spoilers before you've read the book, that won't be an issue today. As always on Novel Romantics, we try to avoid ruining plots for people, which is, you know, kind of us. And in this case, I'm not even sure that would be possible anyway, which hopefully you'll discover along the way of our conversation today. It's not really a novel with a plot that can be spoiled, I don't think. Before we turn to A Paragon itself, I'd like to ask you, Shane, what is it that you love about Colin McCann? Why the crush on Colin McCann?
Well, it's a very good question. I guess, like all the great crushes, it came upon me obliquely. It sort of snuck up on me a little bit. I guess, like a lot of people who grew up in Northern Ireland through the 70s, 80s, and 90s, and still today, the Irish American relationship in all its forms, politics, music, literature. Is something that really it's a really dominant discourse and part of our heritage, and I first came across McCann on the back of a program I studied on in the summer of 1997, which was now known as the Washington Ireland Program for Service and Leadership, which was at that time a cross community leadership development program, which was essentially at its heart designed to bring young people who had shown an interest in social or public life from Protestant and Catholic backgrounds from within Northern Ireland, transplant them into new territory, which happened to be Washington, D.C., and introduce them to the idea of public narrative or storytelling as a means to cross some of the divide that sort of characterized our relationships or lack of relationships back at home. So that idea of storytelling in conflict came to me in 1997, and then when I came back from DC, I picked up a McCann book, but the book that really drew me into his was a book called Let the Great Word Spin, which essentially, it follows a very similar sort of pattern to all of his work, which is as a sort of a fiction, non-fiction concept. And that really appeals to me because, like any good Irishman, I like to live half my life in the real world and the other half In a world of your own fabrication, like all good Irish men, but what I really liked about McCann as well, of course, that he was living in many ways a dream of, you know, he had transplanted himself from Ireland as an author, he'd moved himself to New York, he'd written this extraordinarily sweeping story about an Irish immigrant in New York, 1974, the year before I was born. And I lost myself in that book, in the same way I've lost myself in all of his books. But ultimately, I think what connects me to McCann and my love of McCann is very simple. He is a storyteller, but he's someone who understands the importance of stories. You know, he honors stories and the role they can play in society.
It's super interesting to me that you say that it's the fact that he's a storyteller. And I'm going to try and unpick a little bit why I find that so interesting. And it starts for me with a published conversation that Colin McCann had with the writer that I was trying to think how to describe him. The sort of Sarajevo Chicago writer is how I think of him in my head. Alexander Heyman. Well, because, you know, you can call him Bosnian, you can call him American, you can call him Bosnian American. But I always think, like, Heyman writes about Sarajevo and Chicago primarily, and I kind of mix them together in my head. Anyway, the Sarajevo Chicago author, Alexander Heyman. Heyman and McCann did this conversation where they sort of traded emails back and forth, and then it was edited and published in a literary magazine about maybe 2002 or three. And in that, Colin McCann says that he prefers storytelling, the term storytelling, to overwriting. So he doesn't want to be pinned down as a writer in a kind of creative writing program kind of way, or, you know, you're a writer, you're not producing literature, you're a writer or whatever. But storytelling was the key to him because it was the telling of stories that really mattered about what he was writing. It was, and that distinction mattered. And this never made sense to me. I always thought, like, I've read this thing a lot of times and I teach it, and it's never made sense to me, because I always thought, why would you, like, it seems artificial and like a pose, until I read this book, A Paragon, and I thought, it all clicked into place for me. So go ahead.
So that's interesting. I certainly read that interview, but if we set it in the context of McCann as an Irish author, you know, Ireland has a deep and rich history of storytelling.
Yeah.
You know, a tradition that's still, you know, still quite live. And of course, you know, storytelling, you know, I think is an interesting observation that it was children, you know, the first thing we need comfort and shelter, but the first things we ask for are stories. Mm-hmm. And Ireland has a particularly rich history of storytelling, and the passing on of stories through spoken word and through song, and I think McCann honors. I think that speaks to him. I think he sees this as a tradition, something that he's carrying forward, and I think that's why he clings on to that, and perhaps that's why he writes in this style. So
yeah,
but that's certainly why it speaks to me.
Yeah. No, I think that's really interesting, and it's something that I think, despite the interest that I have in Irish literature and Irish culture myself, like, I never could quite get my head around that. But it really locked into place with this novel, which is maybe a good way to turn to A Paragon, which is a really fascinating novel, and it's a really fascinating piece of storytelling. I think first and foremost, an interesting piece of storytelling. So I'd like to set up what this novel is for our listeners by just in a couple of ways. I want to first say what the word itself means. I want to talk a little bit about the structure of the novel, and also read out the author's note that appears at the beginning, because I think this locks in a lot of different strands that you and I are going to talk about over the next half hour, 45 minutes or so. So a paragon is a word that means a shape with a countably infinite number of sides. And it really, so a countably infinite number of sides, which is a concept that you have to sit back for a while and get your head around. And it's really the structuring, a part of the structuring or thematic concept behind this novel, is that there's a ton of stories in this novel from all kinds of different angles, all kinds of different sides, and you can continually count them up and bring them in as you read them and try and understand what they mean, and they add up to this shape that keeps growing and growing as you read the novel. Now, the other thing that structures this novel is the 1001 Arabian Nights. So the novel is divided into 1001, I don't know if you would call them chapters or sections. They're relatively short, most of them. Some of them are only a sentence long. Some of them are an image. And some of them are several paragraphs long. It kind of depends. But they count up to 500. Then there's 1001 is in the middle of the novel on page 229, in fact. And then they count back down from 500 back to 1. So there's 1001 stories told, but each of those stories has its own sides, and they create different sides themselves in conversation with one another. So the novel itself becomes a kind of a paragon metaphorically. Now, what the novel's actually about brings me to the author's note, which I think explains quite carefully what this novel is about. And this is what he says in the author's note. Readers familiar with the political situation in Israel and Palestine will notice that the driving forces in the heart of this book, Bassam Aramin and Rami Elhanan, are real. By real, I mean that their stories and those of their daughters, Abir Aramin and Smadar Elhanan, have been well documented in film and print. The transcripts of both men in the center section of the book are pulled together from a series of interviews in Jerusalem, New York, Jericho, and Beit Jalal. But elsewhere in this book, Bassam and Rami have allowed me to shape and reshape their words and worlds. Despite these liberties, I hope to remain true to the actual realities of their shared experiences. We live our lives, suggested Rilke, in widening circles that reach out across the entire expanse. And that last phrase in particular, in widening circles that reach out across the entire expanse, also captures something of the tone and theme and big-heartedness of the storytelling that makes up this novel. In its simplest way, it tells the story of these two men, one Palestinian, one Israeli, both of whom have had daughters killed in different ways, one by a bomb and one by a soldier, during the conflict that goes on to this day in Israel and Palestine. To say that that's the story of this novel is really not to do it justice, because, again, it is in a paragon itself. It has a shape with a countably infinite number of sides in it. And it tells many other stories from around the world as it tries to tell the story of these two men involving themselves in what it means to have had their daughters killed in the way that their daughters were killed. So Shane, where is it that you think it's what's an interesting point in this a paragon of storytelling to really begin our discussion today?
Perhaps this point about McCann honoring the complexity of conflict and the complexity of storytelling. So I've heard him quote a line by John Berger on a number of occasions, which is, I'm just paraphrasing, I think, but it's something akin to, never again will a single story be told as if it were just one. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an interesting position to start from, because what it necessitates is if he is honoring that, then his work is necessarily complex. So on the surface, this book can, you know, feel perhaps to someone approaching it sort of impenetrable. It can feel on the surface perhaps slightly chaotic. But of course, what he's doing is he's honoring the complexity of life. He's honoring the complexity of conflict. He's honoring the complexity of stories. He's honoring that sort of interdependence. And I think that's quite rare, not just in his writing or in the kind of literature that we consume today. I think it flies in the face of the nature of a lot of our public discourse and political discourse, which is to sort of either ignore or deny complexity. There's not enough space, to honor complexity. There's not enough trust to allow discourse that is complex to play out. So we end up with a sort of slightly reductionist narrative and public discourse that he pushes against, and I think that's quite brave. And I think it speaks to me because, you know, I growing up in Northern Ireland during the Troubles, I think I learned very early on that stories are complex. Stories in conflict are particularly complex, and they are deeply interdependent. But I do wonder if that's something that's being lost in wider life and wider discourse.
Yeah, whether it's lost in wider public discourse is an interesting question, because it then also leads to another question of like, well, how does the novel become a thing that can try and recuperate or reignite that kind of public discourse, right? And also the story that he's telling, this kind of partly fictional, partly real story that he's telling in A Paragon, asks those questions fairly explicitly, in fact. And it's interesting to see what that approach, what that acknowledgement of other narratives and the openness to other narratives creates in mm-hmm. with respect to how you put together a novel. That there's lots of stories, lots of these individual 1,001 stories. If you start to look at it, even though it's telling, there is a story arc of these two men all the way through the novel, it is also telling 1,001 individual stories, and how these then fit together, and how Colm McCann in particular has really, it's an astonishing piece of work in the way in which he's positioned these stories in order to let them speak to each other without insisting that they speak to each other. So it doesn't have a cause and effect narrative in the way that last month we were discussing on this podcast a detective novel or crime fiction by Attica Locke. And like in crime fiction, everything has to have consequence, or it's not, you know, the crime fiction doesn't make sense and you feel ripped off. Whereas here, there's no insistence on this leads to this, leads to this. It's like almost a collage of here is a story and here's another part of another story, and you're left as a reader to try and piece them together. To illustrate what I mean by this, maybe I'll just pick for me is one of the most striking examples. This novel moves constantly between the personal stories of individuals to world political stories, facts, historical stories and facts, I said a minute ago, collage. It creates a collage. It weaves them together. Every metaphor seems a little bit slightly inept as a way of describing these things. But one of the things that's interesting is right in the opening few pages. So I think the eighth story of the whole novel. And this it's not the eighth. Now that I said that, it's the sixth. But it starts with the word eight, so I'm going to count that as a victory. The sixth story of this novel, in fact, is one that I sent to you over the summer when I was reading this book, and I said, you got to read this book. It says 8 days before he died, after a spectacular orgy of food, François Mitterrand, the French president, ordered a final course of ortolan, a tiny yellow-throated songbird no bigger than his thumb. The delicacy represented to him the soul of France. And you get a couple of pages, or actually just one page, that describes François Mitterrand, the late president of France, eating this tiny bird, which is, I guess, illegal. So they have to do it covered so that, you know, people haven't witnessed it. And it's this interesting statement. It comes on the back of earlier, just like two pages earlier at the beginning of the novel, a discussion of the migratory birds that pass over Israel and Palestine. So there's this image of birds. And in fact, someone finds what is unnamed, but is an ortolan, while cataloging the birds that pass over in those early pages. And then you get this image of a world leader eating the bird. And then 100-some-odd pages later, you get a one-line story that mentions something that François Mitterrand said in that same story you just read. And then for me, what's really, really interesting here is there's a minor image in that scene of that people had to go out and put up these nets to in the forest to that the birds fly into, and they get caught in it, and then they pull them out alive, and they take them to serve them as food. You also get the image of these nets being used to capture birds, to collect them and tag them for research purposes. And then what's really extraordinary to me, and which really floored me when I read it, is halfway through the novel, you get this story, number 496. Parts of the Atacama Desert in Chile have never had any recorded rainfall. It is one of the driest places on Earth, but the local farmers have learned to harvest water from the air by suspending large nets to catch cloud banks rolling in from the Pacific coast. When the fog touches the tall nets, it forms drops of moisture. The water rolls down along the plastic strands and moves through small gutters, collecting at the bottom of the net, where the trickle is funneled into a pipe that leads to a cistern. All across the landscape, high metal poles hold the dark nets against the pale sky. The fog is captured in the early morning before the sun burns the clouds off. Out of nothing, something. The farmers call the nets fog catchers. That was story number 495, a one-sentence story. Mm-hmm. And so there's this image of nets again, collecting moisture. And so it's about creating life. And you have all these different images of things being captured, birds, water, whatever, for different reasons in nets. And then, of course, what goes unmentioned, it's the only mention of Chile in the whole novel. And what goes unmentioned in that mention of Chile is everything else about the history of that country and the recent history of that country, and the dictatorship there and the disappeared people. And it has obvious resonances to the situation of Israel-Palestine, resonances to other conflicts. And it just goes unmentioned, but it was a hammer to me when I read it. Sorry, go ahead and jump in.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. So I've had the good fortune of being in the Atacama Desert, and there's something about that landscape as well that reflects some of the landscape in the Middle East. And you know, if we come back to Mitterrand and the nets, just you know, two echoes of that. So Mitterrand, for anyone who followed his policies with regard to the Middle East, Mitterrand was actually succeeded a long line of French presidents who had a very pro-Arab view in terms of foreign policy. Mitterrand actually was quite a strong proponent of the State of Israel, and had in fact visited Israel on a number of occasions, but did break some new ground in recognizing the PLO as being the sort of the key body, the representative of the Palestinian people. And he was a very strong proponent of the Camp David Accords. So even that is left unsaid. And then this idea of birds being caught, it's really interesting. So one of the interesting things about this book of McCann, but his other books, is there's a thread of their symmetry or repetition that runs across the books. So, for example, on this idea of birds and nets, in Perignon, there's obviously a scene where Petit, the famous French tightrope walker, walks the tightrope line across the valley. And Petit is actually the central character in Let the Great World Spin. The novel basically is set in New York in 1974. And it's set around his famous breaking in to the Twin Towers and then crossing them on a tightrope. But even deeper than that, in Perignon, when he's making that walk, he tries to release a what's supposed to be a dove, but it's a pigeon. And it doesn't quite go to plan, and it ends up sitting on his head and sitting on his arm. So in a way, it's sort of trapped. But in the Let a Great Word Spin, there's a scene where there's a lady who is wandering around the base of the Twin Towers and is picking up the corpses of small birds who have sort of been dazed by the lights of the towers and had crashed headlong into them, like a sort of modern net. And you know, she's picking up these corpses, these birds. Petit wanders past, surveying the area before his tightrope walk. And in the novel, she hands him a feather from I think it was a black-throated warbler. And so you've got these, I mean, that's a very, very specific piece of symmetry or repetition. Now, what's interesting to me is how much of that was McCann aware of before he started writing this novel? Are those things a deliberate repetition? You know, is this actually just him honoring the complexity of stories across his own books? Or actually, is this something a bit more like the Fibonacci sequence, which is, you know, if you look hard enough, you'll see it everywhere. So.
I'm going to make a what I think is a claim on behalf of writers here and say that he definitely knows what he's doing there, and like and is having a little bit of, like, you know, what's really interesting, it's one of the things that I just love about reading literature in general is it almost doesn't matter on one hand, like, because you could, if you make the connection, then it's a real connection, right? And that's part of the point of this novel itself. Is like, if you make the connection, then it's a real connection. And what is that? What is the, what is your openness to that connection and of those stories tell you about what you're thinking, about your own relationship to these stories, and about what these stories mean to each other, and what these stories mean in the world. And also, like, you don't write a whole novel about Philippe Petit and then put him in as an important image and figure in another novel. It was only two novels later or one novel later, and not be, have it on your mind, like, you know. Yeah, for all I know, it's like some of his cast-off material from that novel.
but it is interesting. I have this vision of, so McCann famously writes in a little nook, like a little nook in his home in New York. It's like literally a tiny little sort of cupboard he's taken the door off. And I was thinking about this book as I was going through it, and, you know, having read, you know, his other work. When I was coming across these threads across books, I was thinking, you know, when he wrote, you know, Let the Great World Spin in the sort of mid to late 90s, and he set it around Philippe Petit's tightrope walk and these birds crashing into the tires. And, you know, could he have possibly imagined that, you know, over 20 years later, he would be writing a book about two men whose stories he'd stumbled across narrators of a small part of the conflict in the Middle East? And then when he starts to research this, he finds that, you know, Philippe Petit had also done a tightrope walk, at the height of this conflict, which also involved, you know, a bird being trapped. So for me, there's sort of, I wonder if the way he writes, because it's so expansive and because he goes so broad in seeking out other stories, is it just inevitable that he turns some of this over? Now, on the other hand, I think what is very interesting to me is that this novel, his previous novel, Transatlantic, is a three-part novel. It largely tells the story through the Irish peace process, conflict resolution process, and the last chapter is largely about Senator George Mitchell. So, again, thinking about, you know, the Irish American connection, of course, you know, Mitchell.
And Mitchell shows up in A Paragon as well.
And Mitchell shows up in A Paragon, but it was Mitchell who, in working with McCann on Transatlantic, said to him, if you think Northern Ireland's complex, you should really look at, you know, the Middle East. So here's an interesting. Now, here's a character in his book who's now introducing him to his next book. So he's sort of following the arc of that character, because, of course, after Mitchell left Northern Ireland, he went on to become the special envoy to the Middle East. So there's a beautiful honouring of complexity and the sort of slightly unwieldy patchwork of stories that, you know, I think if you open yourself up to it, you can find connections. And I think that's what he's trying to tell us about conflict and stories in conflict. There is always a way to connect with another through your story or their story.
I think that's a really good way of putting that. And I have to say, I love the phrase unwieldy patchwork. I think that it's a really useful way of thinking about this novel. And it's a phrase that almost sounds slightly pejorative, but it really isn't, because the unwieldiness, I think, is really important to the success of this novel. Yeah. It demands that you piece some things together, and you piece together some of those big public moments, whether it's Philippe Petit and this artistic and act of daring, or Mitchell and this and this act of public diplomacy, international diplomacy, or whether it's the private acts of these two men who are the protagonists of the novel, yeah. Living with their families, dealing with their grief, dealing with their anger, dealing with their hatred, dealing with their love, all of these things. And that intersection between those public narratives and these private narratives becomes a very interesting thing. And yeah. also with the historical narratives.
Absolutely. And it's, you make a really interesting point about the book itself is an instrument. I think it's deliberately complex and challenging, and it can feel like an unwieldy patchwork, because that's what conflict is, that's what life is. The Northern Ireland peace process and the Good Friday Agreement is an unwieldy patchwork, mm-hmm. you know, simply because that's what life is. And I think what McCann does is he refuses to be drawn into a reductionist form of storytelling. I think he is honouring the complexity and the unwieldy patchwork of what it means to be human, if we're going to be honest about that sometimes there are connections to be made, sometimes there are connections that will be made in time, but at the moment seem senseless, and some things just don't seem and never will connect. And I think that's okay, but it's finding the meaning in that. I think is the message that I took away from this book.
Yeah, there's a generosity in that approach to constructing a novel, to writing a novel as well. That there's he doesn't tell you ever what to think about these stories, and none of his characters ever tell you what to think about the story that is being told, or that they as characters and in this case, as real people are living through, which is not always the case in novels, you know, but that he places these images, he's very focused on these images or on these moments and what they tell in and of themselves, or what you can pull from them and how you know, it does demand, I think you're right in saying it demands a lot from you as a reader. It's kind of a thrill. Again. To have that demanded of you.
Yeah, it is a thrill. And I think, again, it's also an instrument. You know, I think it's a very deliberately honouring the complexity of what both these men are trying to navigate. You know, these are on one level. On one level, their stories are very simple. But on any real level, they are extraordinary, extraordinarily complex. You know, their own stories are complex. Their stories together of what happened to them are complex. The story of the conflict in which those events played out is extraordinarily complex. So I think, again, there's something about the book itself honoring that complexity. You know, it's generous. And it's real. It's refusing to kowtow to the idea that I can explain this all away in a very simple linear narrative, which yeah. will probably give us all some comfort. But I don't think, you know, I think his view is, I'm telling a story. I'm a truth teller. You know, I think that's why he likes the fiction, non-fiction, which is, you know, he jokes sometimes about, you know, I think I read one of the interviews he said to Rami, you need to know I'm a novelist, and he said, I make shit up. But his books aren't always about making shit up. All of his books have a thread of nonfiction about them.
They care really deeply about the real things of yes. the real world, don't
yes.
they? And they care
yes.
about this is where that storytelling thing that we were talking about at the beginning comes back. Is like that I'm not a fiction writer, and his, you know, is kind of what I read into that. I prefer the term storytelling or storyteller, and the reason is because it's insisting on those, on the contact with the real world. So Virginia Woolf says in A Room of One's Own, she talks about the fact that a novel is always connected like a spider web to real life, and it may only be touching real life at the corners, but it's still connected. And I think Colin McCann is really deeply interested in how securely the storytelling is connected to the real world as a real thing. while you were saying that, I turned to story 1001, right at the heart of the novel. And I'm not going to read out the whole story, but it is a single sentence. It's a very long sentence. And it has a lot of different people and places and things in it, but it is very tightly focused as well. But it ends with this idea of storytelling and some of the notions of honoring and complexity that you were just talking about. So I kind of want to just pick up in the middle and read the end of this sentence, really. I'm going to read the last third or so of it. And he's talking about people gathering. And he says, having come from as far apart as Belfast and Kyushu, Paris and North Carolina, Santiago and Brooklyn, Copenhagen and Terezin, on an ordinary day at the end of October, foggy, tinged with cold, to listen to the stories of Bassam and Rami, and to find within their stories another story, a song of songs, discovering themselves, you and me, in the stone-tiled chapel where we sit for hours, eager, hopeless, buoyed, confused, cynical, complicit, silent, our memories imploding, our synapses skipping, in the gathering dark, remembering, while listening, all of those stories that are yet to be told. I mean, he just tells you right there in that moment. It's a real thing it's accounting for a real event of people listening and sharing stories together. But he's also telling you what your experience and giving you a kind of permission to have that experience of reading his novel is, because you go through all those emotions, that cynicism that, there's parts of this novel you're like, no, and you get really cynical about it. And there's parts where you feel hopeless, and there's parts where you feel buoyed, and there's parts where you feel eager to read more. And there's parts where you're like, it gives you permission to read in a way that I just think is, that's what the generosity of his writing really comes in there, I think. And it connects to these issues of complexity and of honoring the realness of stories, yeah. and what matters about stories.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me. I was just, his books, I was just thinking about his books, they all have multiple storylines. They all have diverse perspectives. They all have wide sympathies. So he doesn't, as you made a really interesting point, he doesn't take a position, but he's sympathetic. So that sense of generosity and sympathy, I think, again, the book is in many ways a love letter from him to the beautiful complexity that is life, that is stories, but also the power of stories. So, I've been lucky enough since I graduated from the Washington Ireland program in 1997, where I, for the very first time that summer in Washington, had the opportunity and the space to listen to stories of people like me who were completely unlike me, and to be able to really listen in a sort of safe space. And then, my connection to the program led me to support for a sister program that grew out to the South Africa, Washington program, which was a very similar concept, bringing black and white South Africans again to Washington around this idea of storytelling as a tool of leadership in societies where conflict existed. And so then being a third party and listening to their stories and watching them listen to each other's stories in a way that they hadn't been able to do at home for practical or political or psychological reasons. And then, helping to interview and support the early years of what is called the New Story Leadership Program, which is the version of these programs for Israel and Palestine students. And again, seeing them have that. And what they have in common is their story. Mm-hmm. They all have a story. You can strip everything away. You can take everything from them, but you can never ever take their story. And they all have a story, so that is their starting position. And I think that's what he's, that is the point that he's making, which is it's a story can seem like a very small thing, but ultimately that's what binds us all. You know, in the end, that's all there is. It's that Muriel Rukeyser quote, you know, the world's not made of atoms, it's made of stories. And, you know, the world was in that room that you just spoke about.
Yeah. This brings me to maybe that one of the last images that I want to talk about. Maybe we start thinking about the last things we want to say about the novel for this episode at that point. But like the way in which so there's all these different images, and you talked at the beginning about symmetry and patterns, and some of those are ones that you make yourself as a reader that maybe even Colin McCann hasn't thought about, but he's created the stories in creating the stories and placing the stories. He's created the space for you to make those patterns, make those connections. But then there's also the ones that he's placed very carefully and deliberately. And there's lots of those moving around, swirling around in this novel. And one of the ones that really stands out to me for the complexity of it, and that I think becomes in a way, or it could be thought of as in a way as a symbol of the role of storytelling that you're telling, is the one of olive wood. He spends a lot of time in various places talking about olive wood and the different uses of olive and why it's used in different ways and what type of wood it is and how kind of what a remarkable substance it is, basically. And it seems to me that in certain places, and I won't go into this in detail because there's plenty of novel for people to read, but it seems to me in certain places olive is, you know, the olive branch is a symbol of peace, as we all know. And he talks about the olive branch and the dove and Picasso's image of that. But he talks about, you know, the olive wood that is used to make bridges because it doesn't rot. Mm. And he talks about Arafat giving his speech where he says, "Don't let the olive branch fall from my hand." Mm-hmm. And all of these different things and all these facts about the wood and these different images of the wood and olive wood itself kind of becomes, to me anyway, a kind of symbol for that the strength, I suppose, in the permanence, I suppose, of storytelling, and exactly the ways you're talking about there. I wonder what final kind of things you might like to say as we wrap up this episode of Novel Romantics, Shane.
Yeah, well, I think this is a very, very important book in the context of what's happening in the world and the urgent need for us to find new ways to tell old stories,
and to listen to those stories,
and I was just going to say, and to find new ways to listen, because, you know, we're in danger of either drowning each other out or being caught in echo chambers. And, you know, this book sort of builds on a tradition of what you might call public narrative, which is Professor Marshall Gantz at Harvard, who, you know, really influenced the Obama administration, a much celebrated social movement leader, and he talks about the importance of stories in leading movements or in creating movements, and he talks about stories on three levels: the story of me, like what is my story, the story of we, so what connects us, what connects me to you, and then the story of now, what is the story we now need to tell, or we need to retell or refashion. And I think we need to find a way to tell better stories or old stories in different ways, and we need to find better ways to listen to stories and accept that will take time, accept that stories are complex, because when we don't honor the complexity, we get a reductionist view of the world, and we get a reductionist set of reductionist responses to very, very complex issues. So I think it's a hugely, hugely, hugely important novel. I hope enough people, you know, take up the challenge to really think deeply about that, and that in time, you know, it will be seen as, I think, a love story to stories and all their glory and all their complexity and all their possibility. This is what's interesting about the novel, which is we've ended up talking about the novel itself, mm-hmm. as a tool. You know, this book is about. It's a manifestation of what the book is about, you know, in many ways. And I think that's a testament to it. You know, its greatness lies in in what it symbolizes as much as you know the story it tries to tell.
But yeah.
You know, Ireland's relationship with the First World War, Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland's relationship with the Civil War, is an example of the failure of storytelling, of good storytelling. It's a failure of multiple storylines. It's a failure of diverse perspectives. It's a failure of wide sympathies. It's a failure of generosity in storytelling. Yeah. And you know that this book represents everything that, you know, sadly, you know, the partition of Ireland and Ireland's, you know, the precursor to that Ireland's relationship with the First World War. We've never created the space to tell the stories and listen to the stories that need to be told. And you know, it's a damn shame, and that still echoes. But this is I think this whole thing about generosity and diversity and perspectives, it's so badly missing. Mm. I think too many of us are afraid to seek out other perspectives or multiple storylines.
It necessitates a vulnerability, right? Like you got to make yourself vulnerable in a way that people don't want to feel.
Exactly, and it's hard work. You know, it's hard work. You know, there's an absence of honesty about the complexity of life. There's an absence of honesty about the complexity of the issues we face. You know, we've talked about, you know, how that, you know, leadership is socially constructed, and it's much easier for leaders to, you know, categorize everything as a crisis and then pitch themselves as a sort of command and control leader
who's come in,
you know, rather than to stand up and go, it's all very complicated, so we're going to have to figure this out together. I don't have all the answers. I mean, it's just, you know, it's not, it just doesn't fly. And I just think this is such a brave. I think what he does is very brave.
Me too. I just thought this is such a terrific. You know that already. It's such a terrific piece of literature.
I mean, this is one I'll keep coming back to. And again,
did you read Dancer?
No, I didn't read Dancer. But I'll tell you his book that people don't talk about a lot actually, which is a beautiful little book, is 13 Ways of Looking.
All right.
Which I would highly recommend. Which is a very, very unusual little book. It's a it's a sort of novella about this sort of retired judge in his 80s, and it's all set around one day about his journey from his apartment to meet his son at a restaurant, and it all happens between this, you know, that morning and him almost making it to the restaurant. It's almost a sort of whodunit thriller. But even in that book, The 13 Ways of Looking, basically, even within that, the narrow confines of just that morning, what it's about is there are so many different ways to experience or interpret a single event. Mm-hmm. So again, coming back to that, honouring complexity, forcing you to sort of think outside yourself. Again, I think because of the stuff that I did with conflict resolution and the stuff I do with leaders, that sort of speaks to me a lot, because I think that's what good conflict resolution is about. I think that's what good leadership's about too.
Shane Carmichael, thank you so much for joining me on this episode of Novel Romantics. It's been great chatting to you about the novel, and I hope our listeners look forward to reading it if they haven't, or have had some new ways to think about it if they have read it. Join me again next month for another episode of Novel Romantics.
Just so you know, once again, the views and opinions expressed on the show are those of the guests or the host, not the America Centrum, which does not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Thanks again for listening.
Shut up, Shane.
Yeah, keep it down. That's helpful.